You know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's conquering work tasks or doing chores around the house, I need a little treat to reward me. It is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but the cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute delight. And these aren't your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks, okay? Every month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. So you get to snack while you learn? Are you kidding? This was literally made for me. Oh, and by the way, each box ships straight from Japan, straight to your door. Okay, so I'm going to try one of the snacks for you. I got my little guide right here. I think this week I'm going to go for the Soka Senbei Uma Zarame. This Senbei rice cracker boasts a uniquely irresistibly tart and sweet flavor combination of ume Japanese plum and zarame, a coarse granulated sugar. Cool. Now, this says it contains wheat and soy, so that's good to know for you gluten folks. There are plenty of gluten-free snacks in here. Here's the cracker. Ooh, this looks so good. Let me give it a try. Oh my God. You hear that crunch? It's like tart. It's a little salty. It's a little sweet. Mmm. This is delicious. Mmm. And I never would have gotten to try this if Boxu hadn't sent it straight to my house. Mm. And you know, my favorite thing about Boxu is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love trying new and interesting things, or if you know somebody who does, you have got to try out Boxu and get these snacks shipped straight from Japan to your door. And right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's BOKKSU.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I don't know the truth.
Welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover. You know, when I think about what I do, which I do often, I sit there going, what the hell do I do? What do you call this fucking job? Here's what I think it is. What I try to do is I read something, I experience something, I learn something that changes the way that I see the world in fundamental ways. It knocks me off my chair going, what the fuck? Everything is different now. And then I try to tell it to you through comedy. That's it. That's the long and the short of it. That's what Adam Ruins Everything was. That's what this podcast is. That's what my stand-up is. That is what I do. Well, today, I would like to tell you about one of the most mind-blowing things I ever learned. This revelation to me, I still marvel at when I think about it. It is so enormous that it changed the way that I think about the place I live in, the continent that I live in. The way I relate to other people, the way I think about my society, it is truly massive. And here it is. If you grew up like I did, I grew up as a white kid on Long Island in the 90s, taking history class. What you learned, what I learned about the, quote, prehistory, I'm using scare quotes there, of the Americas, is that before Columbus, there were a couple civilizations in Central and South America. You know, there was, maybe you heard about the Aztecs or whatever. But apart from that, it was just Indians hanging out in the woods, not doing much with the space, right? Just a couple people here or there, and a lot of trees and empty valleys and stuff that white European settlers could just come in and make use of. That is the version that we were taught about. I learned about the Americas before Columbus as an untrammeled wilderness, an empty place. And that is a grotesquely incorrect picture. What I finally learned in my early fucking 30s is that that is entirely wrong. New scholarship has demolished this idea of the Americas as a depopulated, empty continent. A recent study that collected decades of work on the topic estimates that there were actually around 60 million people in the Americas at the time of Columbus. 60 million. For reference, the population of Europe at the time was just between 70 and 88 million. So the Americas were basically on par with Europe in terms of population. This was not an empty continent. This landscape was teeming with people. And not only that, the civilizations in the Americas were advanced and dynamic. The Incas created a network of roads as many as 37,000 miles long. This was a couple centuries before Eisenhower did it. The Incas were building roads everywhere. Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital, had hundreds of thousands of people, making it as large as many of the capitals of Europe. And plus, it has, did I mention this? Pyramids. London ain't got no pyramids. And not only that, the people of the Americas were incredibly diverse. In North America alone, there were upwards of 300 distinct languages spoken. So put it all together, we got people, we got cities, we got roads, we got advanced learning and education. How did the story that we tell each other today end up being so incredibly wrong? Well, here's what happened. After Columbus, successive waves of illness, of disease brought to the Americas by Columbus and explorers like him swept across the countryside. The people that lived here had little to no immunity to these diseases, and as a result, they killed up to 90% of the population of the Americas. Yeah, 90%. You know, as in almost everyone. This was a complete cataclysm. The death toll is almost unimaginable. To give you some perspective, it was the largest human die-off in history until World War II, centuries later. In fact, there were so many deaths after the European arrival that the temperature of the earth decreased as a result because a huge amount of farmland was retaken by natural vegetation and became a carbon sink. So many people died, it literally altered the temperature of the earth. But here's the wildest part. There was a gap. Those deaths occurred in the gap between when the earliest explorers like Columbus came to the Americas and when the settler colonizers came decades later. So the earliest European visitors reported seeing shores that were teeming with people, land that was full of civilization. But decades later, when a newer generation of colonizers arrived, they found land that had many, many less people in it. The accounts of those colonizers were the ones that were widely disseminated and read when in fact it was European germs that killed upwards of 50 million people right before those colonizers arrived. And this notion was perpetuated due to a self-serving and racist colonial myth that seems to say, hey, there were hardly any Native Americans here, so, you know, they weren't really using the land. There weren't that many of them anyway. So let's just come in and make our own homes, right? There's plenty of room on this continent. Plenty of empty space for us Europeans to come into and, you know, build our buildings and plant our shit everywhere. It's an empty, untrammeled wilderness. It's ripe for the taking. When, in fact, the people who perpetuated that myth, in many cases, knew quite well that there were people here. It's erasure, pure and simple. Now, this revelation rocked my world. It gave me a stark new way to look at the very ground that I stand on. Like, learning about this is like learning that dinosaurs never actually existed, or that the Earth doesn't really revolve around the sun. That's just a myth that Copernicus made up because he was being sponsored by the Round Earth lobby, which is actually what a lot of flat earthers think. So that one's false, okay? But this one is true. It completely recontextualized everything that I thought I knew about the place that I live in. Now, I read about this in an incredible book called 1491. And this book didn't originate this research, but it did the incredibly important job of reviewing it, surveying it, writing it up into a format that a layperson like me could read and understand, and underlined the importance and the revelations that this new perspective gives us. That is the work of truly great science journalism. It takes the research and uses it to help us see the world in a new way. Well, I am so proud and excited to say that on the show today, we have the author of 1491. Charles C. Mann is one of the foremost science journalists working today. And he's the author not just of 1491, but the follow-up, 1493, and most recently, The Wizard and the Prophet. His work has meant a great deal to me, and I could not be more thrilled to have him on the show. Let's get right to the interview. Please welcome Charles C. Mann. Charles, it's so wonderful to have you.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you.
I'm so thrilled to have you. I've been a fan of your work for a very, very long time. Your book, 1491, which I know is a number of years in the past for you now, but was a huge revelation for me in the way that I thought about the world and the continent that I live on. I've been trying to figure out where to start because your work covers so much ground. You wrote a piece for The Atlantic last June that I thought tied together some threads where you were writing about the pandemic. And a line really jumped out at me that I thought might be an interesting starting point, which was you wrote that for Native Americans, the epidemic era actually lasted for centuries. And I wondered if you could expand on that thought for a bit for us.
Sure. By a bunch of historical circumstances that we can talk about if you're at all curious, when Europeans arrived in the Americas, you know, after Columbus and so forth, there were very, very few epidemic diseases. There are very few diseases that one person could give another in the hemisphere at that time. And so one way to think about the first 150 or so years of American history is to say that all the diseases that had been killing off people in Europe and Asia and Africa for thousands and thousands of years were suddenly dumped on the Americas. You know, they're carried over by the Spanish ships and the English ships. And the result was that somewhere between 2/3 and 90% of the original inhabitants of the Americas died. It was the worst demographic catastrophe in the history of the world. And it kept going on. I mean, you know, the Comanches had, you know, done everything. They kicked out the Spaniards. They kicked out the Texans. They kicked out the Americans. Smallpox comes in and basically does them in. And this sort of, and that's in, you know, the 19th century. And up until, you know, the 30s, plagues were killing off Native Americans because they did not have these exposure to the diseases for centuries and centuries and centuries the way that Europeans and Asians and Africans did. And so in a certain horrible way for Indian country, this is nothing new.
Yeah, I mean, this revelation from 1491, this is where I first encountered it, that the population of North America was vastly, vastly higher than our popular image of it, than what I was taught in school, than, you know, any sort of television or movie depiction of what North America was like, and that disease had wiped out most of the people there before most European settlers even arrived. The earliest explorers brought it. They wiped out how many hundreds of millions of people? An incredibly large number of people, potentially.
An incredibly large number. I mean, it's really hard to know how many, right? Because it's like looking at a bank account that's been robbed and trying to guess how much money used to be there. You know, so you can't really know. But the typical estimates now are that there are, you know, somewhere around 40 to 60 million people in the Americas at the time that Columbus hit. I should note that these estimates keep rising a little bit. But one way to think about that is that there are roughly as many people in Western, in Europe as there was in the Americas, you know, at the time of Columbus. And that picture really dramatically changed over the next couple of centuries.
But this is a truth that, I mean, you wrote this book in 2005, right? Or that's when it was published. And this is based on research that was going on, I assume, for years before that. And, you know, it's only solidified more now. And yet the truth of that is something that, like, we still have trouble internalizing. Like, there there hasn't been a mass change in consciousness of what North America was like among, you know, those of us who now live here. I don't know, there seems to be a problem of, even when we revise our notion of the past, like integrating that into our understanding of the present, even as vis-a-vis the pandemic.
Yeah. And you also, you see things like, you know, for thousands and thousands of years, Native people managed the Western landscape by burning it. right? You know, there is a huge amounts of a, and it's called, even they even have a name for it, tech, T-E-K, traditional ecological knowledge. Mm. And there are techniques for burning this, you know, landscape in such a way as to make it productive and livable. And the people died from epidemics and then followed by, you know, wars and mistreatment and all the other horrible things that then happened. And none of that knowledge was taken up by the U.S. government.
Yeah.
And so he comprehensively mismanaged the forests of the West for, you know, 100, 150 years. And the results are what we now have in California. And yeah. So they kind of, if we truly understood that these landscapes had been thoroughly inhabited by people who figured out how to live there, we might not have made these sort of beginner's mistakes.
I thank you for talking to me about this, even though, again, this is work that you first started diving into, you know, over 15 years ago, because, and I read the book years ago, but every time I think about the revelations from this book, I'm like stunned again every time they come to me. Do you experience that? Are you in that like state of astonishment about this as you think about it?
Yeah. I mean, it's really, really hard to overcome your, you know, what you learned in childhood, right? Yeah. And I learned the same thing probably you did in childhood. I can even recall my textbook saying that the Eastern Forest, you know, was so big and dense that a squirrel could jump from Cape Cod to the Mississippi, you know, just on the branches of the trees. And this was in my textbook. I just thought, whoa, this sort of forest, dark and deep. And, you know, it never occurred to me that, of course, that would be a horrible place to live. You know, there'd be no sunlight there. You couldn't grow corn. You couldn't do anything there. And in fact, people didn't live there like that. There was huge patches of big cleared land. And this was recorded by the colonists. But when the native people were killed off by disease, mistreatment, and all the other things that we talked about, the forest grew back. And so somebody like Thoreau was looking at basically what was a cemetery, right? Where the lands had gone yeah. feral. And he thought it had always been that way. And this is just deeply lodged in, you know, my mind as well. And for obvious reasons, a lot of native people, when, you know, get pissed off about it.
Yeah. I mean, God, just that revelation that, that so much of what we think of as the white colonial experience, though, and, you know, those writers, Thoreau or earlier, settlers who, you know, would write down, ah, look at this primeval forest that nobody lives in. They were experiencing yeah. a relatively new development, a forest that had grown back because right. all of these people had suddenly disappeared and they missed it. They didn't, they showed up just after this happened and they thought that they were seeing something that was ages old. That's incredible.
Exactly. And it's a sort of the founding myth of, unfortunately, the environmental movement. And you see it in things like the Wilderness Act of 1963, which is dedicated to, you know, preserving, what is it, the lands untrammeled by the hands of man, I think is the language in the preface. And it's, you know, actually taking places that were heavily inhabited, heavily modified, and heavily settled by the original people. And yeah. kind of, you know, I think inadvertently writing them out of history, erasing them. And, you know, it's a bad just because it's not true. And it's also bad because it means that we've comprehensively mismanaged so much of the land as a result of this myth. There's a geographer named William Denovan calls it the pristine myth. And I think that's a pretty good word for it. Pretty good term for it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's even beyond those negative consequences. It also means we're not doing the thing that we think we're doing. When you go to, you know, right. one of the great national parks in the United States and you say, ah, we preserved this land. This, we said, no one's going to build anything here. We're going to keep this the way it's always been. That's neglecting the fact that we, including people like John Muir, like, you know, founders of the American conservation movement, kicked out the native people who were living there and by doing so transformed the land that we're actually seeing a landscape that we created in the last few hundred years. We're not seeing a, you know, preserved right. little corner of this is how it always was.
So, and that's particularly true for even for places like Yosemite. Muir went there and he thought that, and it's beautiful. I mean, it is beautiful, but he didn't understand that the beauty he was seeing was because it was a garden. You know, yeah. it was a tended landscape, you know, a quote artificial, if you want to use that kind of language. He saw the people living there who had been living there forever and ever and ever. And he thought they were squatters and they were bad. They shouldn't be doing this because they were doing stuff that was, you know, messing around with nature. And in fact, the Park Service made a concerted effort to kick them out. And I don't think the last indigenous people were kicked out of Yosemite until the middle of the 20th century. You know, so there is this decades long sort of shoving them out of their home process that really gives you a bad taste in the mouth now. Yeah. You go to Yosemite.
Tell me a little bit about how this, you said, what's happened in California now. I assume you mean the devastating fires that we had last year and will continue to have, mm-hmm. which are, of course, you know, climate change plays a piece in this, but how does this mistake, that we're talking about here cause that problem?
Okay. Well, if you go to the far northeast corner, you know, you have the Klamath River, which runs down from southern Oregon and then goes sort of through the mountains and ends up in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. And you have these people who've lived there for a really long time, the Karuk, the Yurok, and the Hupa, and, you know, several other nations. And if you, I mean, they're still here, right? Even though California probably has the, California might have the single worst record of all the 50 states for treating its indigenous population.
Wow.
There's a book that came out a few years ago about California's treatment of its natives by a guy named Mazden. It's called, it's got an unfortunately appropriate title. It's called American Genocide.
Mm.
So these guys, you know, they were given reservations. There was a treaty signed and so forth. And then the state of California didn't want them to have any land. So the California was sort of up for grabs in terms of which, this is in the 1850s and 1860s, whether it was going to be a slave state or so forth. And to appease California, they hid the treaties. They literally hid the treaties for decades.
Hmm.
And the result is they didn't get any land. And when they tried to manage the land in the way that they had for thousands of years, they're arrested or shot. Hmm. Or, you know, jailed or you know, what have you. And there's like tons of records, these guys. And what were they trying to do? They are trying to do preventive burning.
Mm.
They were trying to burn the landscape to prevent the fuel from building up. And there's a whole elaborate techniques that they had developed for preventing themselves from being burned out.
Yeah.
And when they were arrested. So, you know, this didn't happen. And so there's a place in California called Happy Camp, which is a, you know, largely indigenous settlement. They got burned out this year, even though the people in it, the Yurok and Karuk and so forth, had been begging the Forest Service for decades, literally decades, to let them burn the land preventively. And, you know, it was awful. And this has happened again and again and again in California.
California is always one of the places where America's problems seem to almost coalesce and become malignant in a way and like collect, like California as the depository of all these things. But yeah, my understanding is that without that controlled burning, that allows undergrowth to rise up, and which is much more flammable, and that leads to bigger fires.
Right. And it's, you know, it's a pretty simple, process. And, there were, in fact, Forest Service guys, you know, back at the beginning of the 20th century, in the 19-teens and 20s, who saw this and they said, no, we should not have this, policy of, you know, avoiding putting out all, forest fires. We should allow for burning. And there's a big fight within the Forest Service. It was, against these guys, and they were called, Paiute burning, because Paiute apparently meant primitive or bad or something. You know, this was like a slam, and you know, they lost, and so instead the Forest Service and inaugurated what's been called the 10 a.m. policy, which is that every fire started in the forest on day one should be out by 10 a.m. On the next day. And I think there's general recognition that this has been totally disastrous.
Because this results in, if you squelch every fire, then there's no room for little fires to sort of less damagingly burn away what, like flammable material. And then when a fire does come, it's enormous.
Yeah. It's enormous. And so what indigenous fires typically are in the spring when it's wet and the temperatures are cool. Then there's often, you know, rainfall in California, you know, and it gets wetter at the end of the day. So you light an area in the afternoon The cool weather keeps the smoke down. There's not nearly as much smoke. And then it goes out. And then they also have tricks like fire burns better uphill than downhill. So you start the fire on the top of the hill and let it burn down because it burns more slowly. There's all these tricks they know, this tech. I shouldn't call them tricks because it's actually, you know, experience and knowledge.
Technology.
Of the sort when you have a master craftsman, you know, you respect it. So I shouldn't, technology, it's tech. Yeah, it's tech. They know all this stuff. And now typically what you have when you have wildfires is they burn when it's hottest and driest, not when it's wettest. There's no way to put them out. And then they burn up high, right? They burn up and they are called crown fires, and the tree tops of the trees keep going instead of just being down at the leaf litter. And not only is that much more destructive, but it also kills a bunch of trees, and those dead trees then become the fuel for the next fire.
So, I mean, it's amazing how, like, looking at the history of North America, at the history that you're talking about, makes me see one of, like, the biggest disasters that I've been living through. You know, I mean, there were days where I couldn't leave my home last year because of the wildfires that are happening in California. And we here in Los Angeles got far from the worst of it. And looking through the lens of history makes this event look completely different to me. I'm curious, just coming back to the pandemic, to that opening question, do you feel you see the pandemic any differently because of your study of the epidemics that were so devastating to Indigenous people in North America?
Well, if you think about it, one of the reasons that those epidemics were so devastating is that people who had grown up without any idea of communicable diseases were experiencing them. And there's a memoir by a Paiute woman, and there's a sentence in there that really, you know, sort of caught me. She said, "We had no idea a person could pass a disease to another person any more than they could pass a wound to another person." You know, if I cut my arm, I can't give you that cut, right?
Yeah.
And so it's an ailment. And so so the whole idea of communicability is not there because there weren't any communicable, diseases. And so you have, you know, all your natural human reactions are working against you. You know, if smallpox comes into the village, somebody gets terribly sick, what do? The family gathers around that person and comforts them. And what do? They get the disease. They give it to their friends. Everybody panics because this horrible thing is happening. What do? They flee to the next village. What are they carrying? The disease. Yeah. And so the logic of quarantine isn't there. And you're seeing that because now we have so little experience with that. You're seeing really crazy things in our own response to the pandemic that are basically from a lack of real understanding of how diseases spread. And so, you know, all the people who don't put face masks on, all the people who want to get together at family gatherings for the holidays, and, you know, then these become super spreader events or weddings or what have you. All of these human impulses are working against us. And it's in a small way replicating exactly what happened, hundreds of years ago when Europeans first arrived, except now we're doing it to ourselves and we haven't learned a thing from in the past.
I mean, it does strike me that I'm not going to say it's the first time it's happened. I'm sure it's happened many other times, but the degree to which white Europeans, the descendants of white Europeans in North America are, now being attacked by a pandemic rather than being the people who brought it somewhere else, there's an irony to it.
Yeah, there's an irony to it, but the irony would be a little bit better if Native people weren't being hit so badly by it, like the Navajo and so forth. They've had in the Lakota and had terrible suffering from it. But that's not because so much of, lack of knowledge. It's because the healthcare available to Indigenous people is just terrible. And, and so many people there don't have, good electricity and running water and heat. And so it's tremendously exacerbated by poverty, and which is, of course, comes from this legacy of discrimination, which has gone on for so long. So that there's this, you're absolutely right, but there's this really unpleasant side effect. It's actually very, there's a small bit of good news on this. The Navajo, you know, it's been recognized, and the Navajo now, I think, are in terms of just a group of people, they have more than half their populace now vaccinated. I think they're ahead of everybody else in the nation.
It's really can't be understated, though, how much pandemics like this like change the course of history. You wrote again in this Atlantic piece, the historians have seldom noted the connection between measles and the presidency of Barack Obama, which I really love that line. Can you share that story?
Well, it is an amazing story. Basically, Hawaiian Islands, you know, if you think about it, they're a place, again, with very, very few epidemic diseases. They just hadn't come there. And the result was that when Europeans came over there, you know, in their ships, they brought these diseases. This is, again, before the germ theory of disease. It was, you know, they knew about disease, but they didn't know what it was. You know, how really to stop it. And, the problem with the islands, that made it even worse is that there's nowhere to go, right? You can't flee. You can't, you know, go to the next state. So the islands were, beset by this. They're also very worried about the United States, taking them over, the native Hawaiians. And so the king, and queen of Hawaii made this plan to forestall this by formally allying with Britain. And by doing this, they're going to gain the protection of Britain. And so they went on this long voyage over to from Hawaii over to Europe in the 1870s. And, you know, we're about to sign this alliance when, you know, in this horrible, ironic fashion, they went to Europe and they got sick. They got measles and they died. That blew up that plan. The United States did take over, Hawaii exactly as they had feared. And, lo and behold, there's Barack Obama coming from Hawaii to, end up as president as the United States.
I mean, it's such an incredibly sad story with that. That's, I suppose, a light at the end of the tunnel. If you want to find a positive takeaway at the end of a story of incredible destruction and death of, you know, of a very, of an entire culture. I mean, not that Hawaiian culture is gone, but, the amount of life lost was massive.
Yeah. And it's, you know, if you're looking at, indigenous groups today, you can think of them as, surviving a level of loss that, you know, is just inconceivable to those of us who aren't in those groups. I mean, these are people who within, you know, historical memory lost 30, 40, 50% of their people. And then were terribly treated on top of that.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, they find you and you're, you know, dazed and bleeding after being beaten up. And somebody says, oh, let's rob them. Let's rob this poor guy.
You have an incredibly deep knowledge of, you know, Native history in North America and I think or beyond that around the world. How did you come to study that topic? And I'm also curious about how you feel as a white man, you know, studying this topic. Like, is there ever a conflict for you, or is there a perspective that you feel that you bring to it?
Well, first I got interested because, when I was a very little, I moved from Michigan to, area around Seattle. And, it didn't take much to notice that we were living right next to, you know, a bunch of Indian reservations. There's 28, I think, reservations in the state of Washington. Mm-hmm. And, some of these folks, you know, they were around. And, I come from this really sort of uber waspy family. I mean, like, I have ancestors on both sides of my family that were actually literally on the Mayfly.
Wow.
This is sort of what my parents were fleeing, actually, to come to Seattle, where that wouldn't matter. And so, you know, I was sort of, even as a kid, I was sort of used to this idea. I come from an old family. You know what I mean? And yeah. I looked at these guys. I thought, like, no, I didn't. You know, I'm a newcomer. And then I don't know if you've ever seen, the art of the Pacific Northwest, but it's just amazing.
Incredible.
It's beautiful. And, even as a kid, I mean, I could tell this was really great stuff, and it was really different. And it, you know, was organized, I would now say, on aesthetic principles that were completely different from, you know, European aesthetic principles. And so, then, but I didn't really do much of that. I just knew that they were interesting and important people, until, you know, as a young adult and a science writer, I went to, Yucatan, and I saw the Maya ruins, and I'd been to Greece and Rome, and I thought, oh, wait a minute, these ruins are bigger. Yeah. And to my, you know, inexpert eye, they look just as impressive. And I thought, like, wait a minute. In my high school, we talked about Greece and Rome, which I think we should. But I don't know if the word Maya was even mentioned. And this is my own hemisphere.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, started getting curious. And that, you know the way is if you're at all freelancer, one thing leads to the next. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I did want to answer your second question. I did think like, oh, you know, I'm not like a white guy. I'm like the pastiest white guy you ever saw. you know, super waspy. And so, so I want, and you know, in my inexpert way, I wondered, well, should I do this? And I talked to a guy early on named Russell Thornton, who's actually at UCLA, Cherokee guy, really, really excellent guy. And so I unburdened myself. You know, he hit it off and I unburdened. And he said, well, I'll give you some advice. He said, what? He said, a whole lot of white people forget that the people that they're writing about are human beings.
Yeah.
So if you just keep that in mind, you'll probably be okay. And, you know, it's really true. I don't want to hold up myself up as any kind of exemplar because I'm certainly not, but I can say that, as I read stuff, quite often it occurs to me that the writer, you know, who looks like me, hasn't realized that Native people are in the room.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You're right. And so, I was just talking to a guy about, there's a, I hate to, you know, pick out a guy, you know, as a stick to beat with, but I'm going to do it anyway, I guess. There's a guy named Gwyn, who wrote, Pulitzer nominated, Pulitzer winning, I forget, History of the Comanche, of Kana Parker, this amazing guy who was, you know, one of their major figures, called Empire of the Summer Moon. I think Brad Pitt or somebody's making a movie of it. And if you just read it, it's talking about how, they had, right in the beginning, talks about how the Comanche had held back civilization. And, these people were the last untamed, literally using that word, Indians in there. And I'm thinking, Comanche are actually reading this. And they're right. thinking, you know, wait a minute.
right.
Wait a minute. We're civilization.
yeah.
Right. And what the heck? I'm tamed. You know, I'm now tamed. You know, who's going to like that? And you can say, what you're talking about, but, you know, remember that they're in the room.
Yeah.
And, you know, luckily, for me, you know, I'm sure there are Native people who absolutely hate what I'm written and hate everything I stand for, but they've been kind enough not to tell me.
I mean, how do you think of yourself when you're diving into these topics? Because sometimes I think of, you know, again, as another white person, I think like, well, I'm the ignorant person, you know, like I grew up, you know, as a white kid on Long Island, hearing the same stories as everybody else. And I hope that by, you know, engaging on a voyage of discovery and publicly modeling it and being astonished by what I find, I can help draw other people from ignorance to knowledge, because there's other ignorant people like me who kind of need to hear it, you know, and that's sometimes what I think my role is. You know, maybe there's white people out there who are more likely to listen to another dumb white guy when he's like, oh shit, I just learned this stuff. You know what I mean? That's what I hope I can have the role of. Because I'm fascinated by these topics as well. But I mean, you're doing on the ground research. You're talking to Native experts and doing these sorts of things. And I don't know, is there anything that you do in particular to make your role fit for you and do it in a way that, you know, is, as you say, respectful?
I guess I try to indicate that I'm really interested in hearing what they have to say.
Yeah.
And that it may, you know, affect what I do and how I write. And the other thing I think, this is going to sound hopelessly hokey, but it's like one of those things where it's, you actually believe the hopelessly hokey thing. So, is this, that I think that, you know, a really good book is, on some level, an act of generosity. You know, that you're trying to approach it in a generous fashion.
Yeah.
You know, years ago, I saw Penn and Teller, the magicians, and they said, don't think of us as these big experts. Think of us as these ordinary guys who've learned a couple of cool things and want to show them to you because they're so cool. and that's how I sort of think. You know, I got the chance to meet these amazing people.
Yeah.
And they have told me really, really cool things. And the other thing is that, you know, a Native person who is 75, say, has had extraordinary things happen in his or her life. You know, there's an incredible store of hundreds of thousands of people out there with just amazing stories. And it's a privilege to, you know, when they, you know, from time to time, they'll let me listen to them. So I just feel really grateful about the whole business. And I'm very happy to try to share it. It's hokey, I know.
It's not at all. It's not at all. I think that's a very fundamental human trait to, you know, that's a lot of what I do as an entertainer is I learned something and I thought, that's amazing. I want to tell other people. And that's such an honest emotion to have that other people respond to it when that is the basis of your work. That's really cool that you feel similarly.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been just for this project we're doing, reading about Chaco Canyon now, which is this, you know, sort of enormous site that's in the Southwest, not all that far from you guys in New Mexico. And, you know, the details that the archaeologists, you know, and especially now in the last few years when they've been much more interested in working with Native people about recovering what life was like for those people, you can just get this little picture. And I was thinking, oh, and I just had the gasp, you know, literally yesterday, as I was writing this, sort of thinking, this is going to be so much fun for people to read because I had so much fun learning it.
And before we go to break, this new book that you're working on, you were telling me before we started rolling that it's a bit of a sequel to 1491 about the American West. Just tell us, give us a little, a little taste of it.
So this is the sort of official version. The basic idea is that, you know, my kids, a little while ago, I'm from the West and started mentioning, oh, wouldn't it be fun for us to go back there? You know, and I was sort of imagining what would it be like this place that they're going to be 20 years from now, 30 years from now, if they were to do that. And, you know, you can't predict the future, but there's some things that would be really strange if they didn't happen. Right. So, you know, you can't know who's going to be president, but you can know that barring something really weird, the West is going to be hotter and drier than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every study says hotter and drier, right? Even the Colorado River is going, it's like 11th drought in the last however many years or whatever the number is. You know, California looks like it's going to have another drought. Oh, you know, you hear this all the time, right?
Yeah.
Hotter and drier. The other things you can say about it, you know, whatever happens, it's going to be a center of energy, you know, the center of the energy industry. You can also say it's going to be a mixed up multicultural place. It's going to have, you know, 40% of its people are Hispanic origin or whatever the number is. You know, 9-10% indigenous, you know, there's a whole bunch of, Asians on all along the Pacific Rim. I don't know what the numbers are, but the point is it's a, you know, jumbled up, mixed up multicultural place. And the final thing is that, since, you know, I was a kid, one of the clearest things that's been happening is that the, indigenous groups of the West, there's, I think, 294 federally recognized tribes have, I think that's the number, have, been recuperating their sovereignty. You know, they're going to be more and more like, you know, independent nations. And so, so think about this future 30 years from now with this hotter, drier, you know, super complicated mosaic of ethnic groups. That looks a lot more like the West of 800 or 1200 than it does the West of 1900.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, the distant past has more relevance now than in the future. And I thought, you know, what if I wrote a history of that West, the West that's coming? And that's the idea.
That's amazing. I'm looking forward to that so much. I want to talk about some of your other work, but we got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with more Charles C. Mann.
Oh. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm a real, you know, super print guy, so I don't actually listen to that many podcasts, but I have listened to you, and I thought, this guy sounds sort of like me. I don't think I sound as good, but I mean, basically, in a sense that, I think of myself as sort of like, you know, like my Labrador, mindless enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And that's my stock and trade. I learn things that go, well, that's really cool.
Incredible. I feel that way when I read your work. I'm like, oh, I feel like our brains work a little bit similarly in terms of what I'm interested in and the enthusiasm that I have for these topics. You're also, I want to say, one of my favorite Twitter follows because my guess is from reading you is that you just sort of like are, you know, you spend a lot of time reading research, new studies that come out, and you just sort of tweet when something strikes you as really fascinating. And so as opposed to people who tweet every angry thought that they have, every tweet of yours is like, oh, here's something really interesting. Here's a really fascinating new idea that just came out. How do you go about that?
I actually don't think I have all that much to contribute in the discussion of whether Donald Trump is awful or not, you know what I mean? Or, you know, all these other subjects.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I just don't think I have that much to say. But, you know, I can read scientific papers and, you know, every now and, you know, the great thing about it is scientists are not allowed to write well. I mean, they're actually punished if they are. So they'll take something and there's like, they're out to bore you, but then you tunnel in, you think like, holy crap, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, in all sorts of different ways. And, so then I thought this is fun to share because I don't actually think my like personal opinions about most stuff is that interesting.
Well, you're like, as we all are, you're a lens, right, through which you're viewing this work. You have your interests and your understanding, and then, you know, you're able to take it and hold it up for us and say, oh, I found this interesting, and in a way that is a little bit more intelligible. I'm not someone who can read habitually every day dense academic prose. I can when I'm motivated by a research project, but it's not my day job, you know? And so you hold it up for me and I see it and I go, oh, wow. Okay. This is interesting. Charles pointed out what is cool about this. And then maybe I take that and I do that for somebody else. 'Cause you're one of the people that I read.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I read this so you don't have to. I read a lot of really bad prose.
I often think of what I do as, you know, in entertainment and television as taking, you know, work from very good writers like yourself. But, you know, a lot of the audience is not able to spend, you know, their evenings reading because they have kids. They're very busy. They only have 22 minutes at the end of a night to watch something. And so I take it and I make that final translation of, you know, I read this so you don't have to and turn it into television. As I look at all your work, I think there's like a connecting thread of our relationship with the natural world as humanity. I mean, even as you're writing about indigenous cultures and societies, there's that connection with, you know, how you know, different cultures have managed forests and et cetera. I know there's that's very much the theme of your book, The Wizard and the Prophet. Do you feel that theme running through?
Sure. Very much. You know, I grew up in the 70s and the environmental movement was on board. And I also grew up in a really beautiful place, you know, relatively rural part, you know, the exurbs of Seattle. And so it's been an overwhelming concern of mine. And I also think, you know, in a way that this particular time that we're living in, it's the biggest issue we have, which is, are we going to figure out a way to live with our environment that doesn't bite us in the ass and, you know, gives us a good place for our kids and grandchildren to live. And we're going to be making these decisions, in the next 20, 30, 40 years about what kind of place we're going to be in. And they're going to resonate for centuries upon centuries.
Yeah.
And so as a journalist, that's the biggest story there is, I think. And so it's, you know, something I keep thinking about a lot.
I recently had Elizabeth Colbert on to discuss her new book, Under a White Sky, which I have not yet had the chance to read. But, you know, I'm familiar with her work and had a really wonderful conversation with her. She has a really, I want to call it sort of devastatingly clear-eyed view of how we have altered the planet and our prospects for preserving it or reversing any of those alterations. I'm curious about what your overall view is about, you know, climate change or, you know, the project of changing the planet overall. Are you, do you feel optimistic or pessimistic, or do you, where do you put yourself?
Well, I guess here let me ask you a question. Here, I'll tell you what it seems to me to be a really plausible scenario for 30 or 40 years from now. We blow past 2 degrees and we're at like 2.5 degrees. Okay. So there's a lot of bad stuff happens from that. But, right now there's 1.3 billion people without electricity and like 2 billion maybe without potable water. Those numbers are going down. And it's quite possible that that same future will have, you know, hardly anybody without electricity, hardly anybody without running water. Is that a bad world or a good world?
Oof. I mean, I guess I want to know more about the prospects of, I want to know more about what that world looks like, right? Because how many people are being forced to, you know, move from where they live? Is Arizona still habitable?
Yeah, the answer is yes, because we know that, you know, in a severe drought that lasted for a long, long time in the 12th century, and then there is one in the 9th century, you know, there's been these mega droughts that have lasted for decades upon decades in Arizona. And Chaco Canyon was built in the middle of these fantastic irrigation systems in southern Arizona of the Hohokam, where they were based on this sort of radically different idea about how we should deal with water, you know, were all built during these times when it was extremely hot and dry.
Yeah.
So the answer is yes, it could be. Is it going to be like it is now? No. You know, but is it, you know, have people figured out how to tolerate and live decent lives? And
Yeah.
You know, and it's again a question. Obviously, if a single family is forced to move and become exiled because of, you know, climate change, that's a terrible tragedy that will shake that family forever. But, you know, suppose on a planetary level, when you have, you know, 8 or 9 billion people, 100 million people over a space of 20 years are forced to move.
Yeah.
But 1.3 billion people gain electricity at that time. Mm. I mean, how do you balance all that? I don't know.
Yeah.
But just, that seems to me a more accurate answer is that really bad stuff and really good stuff will happen. And because that's the way it's always been in human history.
Yeah. Yeah. Making that calculation is you have to do sort of Peter Singer levels of ethical calculus to try to do it. And,
right.
And even if you did, how would you know if you got the right answer? But you're right. I mean, we have to judge those things. To answer your question, I don't know how I feel about that future because, okay, 2.5. Well, let's say that means that the coral reefs are lost. Let's just and they wouldn't have been if we had hit some arbitrary other number. Mm-hmm. I think, well, that's bad because I love coral reefs and I do think we have a duty to protect the natural world. And I do think it's bad for, you know, unique species biodiversity to be wiped out. But on the other hand, we have a moral obligation to each other and to the rest of humanity and to prevent human suffering and death. And it's a difficult question to answer. I don't think we should view it as a trade-off that we have to have one to have the other, that we have to kill the coral reefs for those people to get electricity. I think that's a false choice that is often pushed on us by those who don't want us to preserve the environment and just want us to keep burning oil because, hey, that makes we can buy better, you know, we can buy more stuff that way. But
yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I think your moral duty is to do as much as you can to protect the coral reefs. I'm just saying if that was an outcome.
Yes.
You know, how would you feel about it? And it's a very complicated situation. If you go, as I did for the research in The Wizard of Profit, to, you know, tribal areas in Northeast India, people are really, really poor there. And to see what even a small amount of electricity can mean for people in that situation is really profoundly moving. To see families, you know, have these little solar panels and then they get lights and suddenly, you know, the kids can do their homework at night. People can, this family I was visiting was making these things, these sort of home rolled, cigarette like things, bindis, you know, that has a little bit of extra money that makes a huge amount of difference when you don't have very much money. You know, there's all kinds of things that are happening with just a little bit of electricity. And you think like, yikes, you know, how do you weigh what that means to those families versus the other things that are in question? I just don't know.
So the Wizard and the Prophet, I've not been so lucky as to read this book yet, but it's been on my list for a little while. I apologize. I've read two of your books, Charles. Don't be mad at me that I haven't read every single one. But I read enough when the book came out about it to know that it's about this conflict between who you call the wizards and the prophets, the folks who want us to cut back and the folks who say, no, we can build better. We can invent new things that will improve life.
Right.
And I detected that distinction in your question to a certain extent.
Yeah, exactly. It's about it's a sort of a hybrid book, which either means it's a brilliant mashup or a complete mess. and it's a mixture of a dual biography of these two guys who I think are really important and hardly anybody has heard of. And one of them, the slightly better known one, is a guy named Norman Borlaug. And he's the main figure in what's been called the Green Revolution, which is the mix of hybrid crops, irrigation, and high intensity fertilizer that came in the 1960s and 1970s and doubled, tripled, or even quadrupled grain yields throughout much of the world, and is a big part of the reason that people like Paul Ehrlich, when they wrote The Population Bomb and these sort of classics in the 1960s, thought that there was going to be massive famines. And effectively, those famines didn't happen. Mm. And so they see numbers around like Borlaug saved a billion lives and so forth. It's always more complicated than that, but that's the basic idea. And he's a really remarkable figure. And the second guy who's truly obscure, in fact, I occasionally meet people who know who he is and I'm completely shocked, is a guy named William Vogt, V-O-G-T. And, you know, and I see ringing no bells and you're like the 99% yeah, of people in the world or 99.9% of the world. Right. So this is like a really, really, you know, smooth move for me commercially, which is writing a book, a biography about two people nobody's ever heard of, both of whom are dead even. Mm-hmm. And he is the guy who put together the ideas behind the modern environmental movement. And that is, the fundamental idea is called carrying capacity, which is that there's a certain finite amount of use and consumption that can come that people can do on Earth. And if we do more, we surpass the limits set by natural systems and catastrophe is the result. Mm. And, so we have to, you know, cut back and put on our cardigan sweaters and, you know, turn down the thermostat and all those kinds of, things that, you've heard. And if you think about it, the two ideas, Borlaug, which is that we can, you know, you put on our science hats and, you know, produce our way mm-hmm. out of our dilemmas. We can make more. We can make more better. And Vogt's idea, which is, no, that's crazy. We have to, you know, cut back. They're kind of the opposite from each other. And Borlaug and Vogt hated each other. They only met once and they immediately didn't get along. And Vogt tried to get Borlaug shut down in this sort of half-assed way. That's pretty much where the dialogue has been ever since the day in 1946 when they met. You can think of it as two ends of a mm-hmm. spectrum or a continuum or something like that. And of course, nobody is perfectly one or perfectly the other, but it's amazing how often they line up. And so you know, if there's a certain type of person who's against nuclear power, who's against GMOs, who's, you know, in favor of large, swaths of untrammeled wilderness. And then there's these other people who want everybody to pack into cities and, you know, these high tech, things with lots and lots of portable, you know, nukes powering everything and sending us to Mars. and they both think of themselves as environmentalists, right?
Yeah. Though here's the thing. I feel like hearing you talk about it, that maybe those two strains are coalescing for me a little bit. I had a while back, we had a man named Saul Griffith on the show who's, you know, an engineer who, you know, talks about how we can not solve the climate crisis, but make our biggest strides in addressing the climate crisis if we massively, you know, electrify our grid, convert to sustainable energy sources, you know, drive down the cost of solar, all those sorts of things. And that produces a world that is fundamentally better, where energy is cheaper, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I see that same, now that's, you could say maybe a technocratic pro-capitalist, you know, he's a startup founder, all those sorts of things. And, you know, that's that kind of version, but that's not that different from the Green New Deal approach, which is, you know, similarly from the most strident environmentalists are now saying, no, we can actually create jobs, have a better economy if we take climate change really, really seriously. Seems like they're sort of coming together in that approach to me.
A little bit. I mean, I think both sides would agree that, you know, one big part of the answer to climate change is electrifying everything, mm-hmm. you know, and then generating that energy in a carbon-free way. So far, everybody's on board with this. But there's a whole other argument that one side says, well, that simply can't happen. From solar and wind. It has to happen with nuclear and probably it's going to need fossil fuels. And we're going to have something called carbon capture and storage to, these big plants to capture the CO2 and inject it into the ground. And so there's this big central, and all that involves big centralized facilities, you know, feeding it out to everybody, which is sort of the model we now have because there's been these economies of scale and so forth. The other side says, no, that's anti-democratic. These institutions don't care about you. What we need to have is these networked, neighborhood level installations of, solar and wind. Everybody's, you know, me and you swapping our power, back and forth, all under our control. We're all living much closer to the land. Do you see the difference between, and these guys say, no, that will never work. And, you know, so there's a big fight in there, even though you're absolutely right. They both say electrify everything and do it in a carbon-free way.
Yeah.
Now, is it impossible for people to find a common ground? No, this is not like a law of physics or anything. I'm just saying that if you look at the history of the last 60, 70 years, this fight in different ways has been going on ever since Borlaug and vote. You see it in the food system. There's a guy, terrific writer, Mark Bittman. He's just written a book, which is about how, in his view, animal vegetable junk. And he's terrific. And it's about, in his view, how giant agriculture has ruined the food system. But the opponents will say, well, that's just crazy, because what that is highly productive, and it means we can use less land for agriculture, and we should be doubling down on this and, using genetically modified things so that we'll have the ultimate goal is to have a single square mile of, hyper productive corn feed everybody, everything in the rest of the country be, wilderness. And that, so there's another area which that fight is going on. Or in California, where you have water, where you have, this tremendous fight between people who want to say, no, we shouldn't be having golf courses and lawns. We need to have xeriscaping and live in a desert environment. And other people say, no, let's build all these giant desalination plants and power them by nukes. And, California has 25 gigantic plants, plus this huge thing where they're going to take the Sacramento River and funnel it down south in another giant canal project. Wow. You guys, I think it's the last non-channeled river in California. There's some huge project they want to build in the inner part of the state. So that's another part of that kind of fight. So it's going on, under your feet. I guess literally. And there you are in Los Angeles. It's your water that they're fighting about. You should really pay attention to this.
Yeah, I don't know about this one. But is there, I'm not going to ask you to choose a side, because I feel like that would be inimical to your project. And I feel like I know what your answer would be to that. But to me, my question is there a synthesis of those approaches? Because when I look at it, I say, the cutback mentality, I spoke about in the intro to our episode with Saul Griffith, that it's sort of fundamentally self-defeating. People won't do it. You can't tell people just to live worse lives in, with colder thermostats.
You're right.
And it mathematically won't solve the climate crisis, even if we did that. And then on the other hand, the idea that, we can continue growing at exactly the same rate, that we have to change nothing. We can continue. Exxon can keep having massive profits. The economy can keep growing by this amount every single year, and we can solve climate change at the same time. People who are wedded to that idea tend to propose solutions like going to Mars or carbon capture, which are unproven. They're trying to have their cake and eat it too, in a way that when you look at it, it doesn't actually pencil out. The research isn't there. And really, they're just asking permission to keep doing what they're doing and fuck future generations. And so I look at it, I'm like, well, at the end of the day, it seems like we need to synthesize these two views and find some sort of, I don't want to say middle ground, but what is your view on that?
Oh, I mean, again, this is not laws of physics, right? So obviously you can synthesize them. The question is whether people will. And so, here I'm now, what I was telling you before, I think pretty much throughout this, conversation was in the realm of fact, right? I was trying to tell you facts that yes. happened. So now you're asking me, could there be a synthesis? And we're entering a different realm. And I'm just some guy. at the coffee shop,
right?
that you were unlucky enough to sit next to. So, and we somehow got into this conversation.
Yeah.
And because you were so desperate for conversation after COVID that you would talk to anybody, you're willing to hear me out here, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You understand what I say? This is with John Cabot. So I guess I think about it often in this. I talked to a demographer, a really smart guy once named Nathan Kivitz, and he told me that when he came to scientific disputes like this, he thought, what would happen if you granted each side their essential premise? Mm-hmm. And, what if you did? So, one side's premise for nuclear power is that nuclear power is safe.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not going to kill anybody. And the other side's, premise is that it leads, quite naturally to giant corporations and utilities that are completely unresponsive to democratic pressure and end up not giving a rat's ass about the lives of the poor workers who have to get all the uranium and this all sort of stuff. So what if you said both of those are true?
Mm-hmm.
That it's safe, but it has this. So to me, again, I'm just the guy in the coffee shop here. I think, well, what if we had like you thought of nuclear power as a bridge fuel? Mm-hmm. You know, what if we built small, easily decommissioned neighborhoods, so to speak, nukes? And they exist. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if in New York, they have them right in Columbia University, and in Chicago, I think still has its own reactor, the one that Fermi built,
yeah.
you know, back in the 40s. And there's all these small scale things. Now, and those are like under democratic control. I mean, they're right in the middle of big cities and they have not killed anybody.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at this, and the same thing is essentially true with all those, nukes that power nuclear submarines.
Yeah.
You know, they're fine. And so what if we did things like that on a scale, and that gave us a little breathing room while we figured out renewable energy, which is still, you know, not renewable energy. I mean to say solar and yeah. wind, which is still in its infancy.
Yeah.
You know, what if we had nukes and said, we're going to build a bunch of these and they're going to last 30 years or 40 years or whatever
yeah.
this is. The great merit of this idea is that whenever I have brought it up, everybody hates
it. It makes nobody happy. But that's what they say. That's what they say about a good compromise. A good compromise is one where no one's happy.
Right. And I do think it, that kind of thing. Here's another example for agriculture. You know, agriculture is a big climate issue. There's a whole host of issues around agriculture. Mark Bittman is completely right about everything. I don't mean his book is very good.
I can't wait to read it.
Diss him. You think like a whole bunch of people are very opposed to genetically modified organisms, you know, due to GM plants. So what if we, again, grant the two sides there, the best, and say, look, these things can be regulated, right? They are safe. You know, they're not going to kill you. The other side, you're absolutely right. This is feeding into a system that has enormously destructive environmental and social, consequences. So if you think about it, the research in agriculture, which is what GMOs are about, is concentrated in like 5 or 6 crops, you know, wheat, rice, mm-hmm. corn, the biggies. There are hundreds of other crops that are just completely ignored. And a lot of them are way more beneficial in a climate point of view. I think particularly of tree crops, which, arboriculture, it's called, and is a big deal in the global south in places like West Africa and in the Amazon, where there's literally hundreds of tree crops. They're completely wild, essentially. And they are very, very difficult to develop by conventional breeding because they have such long generation times. Breed them and then wait 10 years and then breed them. That's why like the American Chestnut Foundation is moving so slowly to bring back the American Chestnut. What if you use that technology to develop tree crops, which use much less water, much less fertilization, provide shelter, you know, provide all kinds of other benefits, and took places that are dry out, and you had this kind of arboriculture or silviculture, and you could also mix it, as is in the case in northern Mexico or much of West Africa, with cattle, and there's a good reason to do that, and use this technology to bring in more climate-appropriate agriculture.
Yeah.
This is another solution that everybody hates, but I have a kind of think that it might work. But remember, I'm just the guy at the coffee shop here.
Right. No, I'm not holding you to this piece. Okay, arboriculture expert Charles C. Mann says that we should start small nuclear reactors all over Africa. No, I understand the point that you're making. And, you know, to me, it comes down to what solutions are actually going to be effective and which ones are wishful thinking. And it's often harder than you think to tell which is which, right? Cutting back, saying everybody should cut back on everything mm-hmm. and that we should, make our footprint smaller is itself a form of wishful thinking, because you can do that sometimes individually. And, you know, you can use less plastic bags and you can turn down your thermostat and you can think I've done my bit, when actually the solutions that are needed are in a more top-down way. Similarly, you can say, oh, well, hey, you know, let's move to a bridge fuel, but the bridge fuel is natural gas, you know, you've actually not solved the problem either.
Yeah, exactly. I do wish that there is more imagination. You know, people talk about how we need more innovation and so forth, which is absolutely dead true. But I also think we need more imagination and more willingness to do this. And the reason that I think this isn't crazy to ask for is that fundamentally, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't really know what's going to happen 30 or 40 years from now from climate. We don't really know what the consequences of 2.5 degrees or 3 degrees or 2 degrees are. I mean, you know, we can project, but we don't actually know. We similarly don't know how fast battery prices can go down or how cheaply we can make nukes or any of these things. It's a giant leap in the dark. And that's one of the things that I find consistently most personally annoying about environmental disputes is that people are very, very confident about things that I don't think that there's any reason to be confident about at all. Mm. And there's a terrific book called Climate Shock by the Weissman and Gernot Wagner, the late professor at Harvard and Gernot Wagner. And its whole point is that the big scary thing about climate change is that there's this possibility of really weird stuff happening.
Yeah.
That is unpredictable and we don't know because it's such a complicated system. And, you know, to me, it translates out as, gee, I'm so glad we randomly fooled around with the constituents of the atmosphere because, you know, finish that sentence.
Right.
You know, there is no way to finish that sentence, you know, and we really, there's a, you know, a non-zero chance that something really weird could happen. And I just see no reason to experience that risk. But avoiding it also involves a leap into the unknown, which is, means among other things that there's never going to be things for, in the foreseeable future for journalists like me to write about, but also means we're on this kind of scary ride.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right that, you know, the climate is such a massive system and pushing it in the direction that we're pushing it is going to have effects that we can't predict. I mean, the, you know, just reading about the polar vortex that, you know, overtook most of the country a few weeks ago as we're recording this, like that's not something that I think a lot of people would have predicted a few decades ago, that the jet stream would be disrupted such that this huge mass of polar air envelops all the way down to, you know, South Texas. Is that's weird, right? And surprising, and there's going to be other weird, surprising results. Some invasive species is going to be let loose in an area that we didn't predict because its range changed because XYZ, and that's going to have a massive effect. And the amount of uncertainty that we're going to be living with is maybe the only certain thing.
Right. And you know, and it could also work out positively. One of the things that's really interesting is that there's this sort of sub-literature in this idea of the effects of what they call black carbon, which is soot, largely from coal, burning, and particularly in Asia, where most of this sort of dirty brown coal, as they call it, is burned. And it gets onto the Himalayas and it, you know, goes up high in the air and it goes on and it lands on the snow of the Arctic and Antarctic and so forth. And it darkens the color of it. You know, in the scientific language, it changes the albedo. It changes the amount of light it reflects. And when dark things get hotter and it adds to tremendously to the melting of the ice caps. But the effect is incredibly short lived. So if you really ended coal quickly, which I think is actually going likely to happen, you have this giant positive effect that suddenly happens, and it happens within months of the next snowfall covers up the snow, and then you don't have the, and you're actually changing the color of the planet. And this, of course, should give you pause, but it might be good. And it's this kind of thing, as far as I know, that the research on the black carbon and the research on the different colors of vegetation and how they affect there's a whole branch of new research on how warm air coming in from the Atlantic is affected by the color of the vegetation in the Middle West. And, you know, there's these mind-bogglingly complicated things that are all intertwining in a way that is not yet we're not yet able to put together with confidence.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but if you don't know what the outcome is, it could be positive.
This is an incredibly fascinating conversation, and I wish I could talk to you forever, Charles. But I gotta bring it in for a landing somehow. In terms of looking at all of your work, looking at your really deep research into a knowledge of you know, native cultures and societies and the history of them heading, you know, going back millennia in North America. And then your research into climate change and into how we are affecting the planet. That's a very deep understanding that I feel you have headed in two directions, right? of a world, you know, a world of the past and a world of the future. And I wonder if you find yourself coming to any conclusions about them that others don't have because you have that perspective. Or is there any surprising moments at which you find those two strains in your work coming together and colliding?
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, one of the things that's really striking to me is that in the past 20 or 30 years, we've learned a lot about the past climate of the West and how it's subject to these enormous swings, these mega droughts, as they call them. And just last year, in the spring, two really quite good scientific teams concluded from separate areas of evidence that the West is entering one right now. Wow. Now, in the past, they had other causes. Now it's climate change taking a normally big dip, if that makes any sense, and making it deeper. And the West, you know, they feel is going to be much more like something that we haven't seen for hundreds of years. And here I am reading this, you know, it's on the front page of the New York Times.
Yeah.
And I'm reading about what life was like in the West, you know, in 1200.
Yeah.
And how people, you know, built these really thriving civilizations and what the principles were for them to do this. And I'm thinking like, whoa, you know, these interests of mine are colliding just a little bit here. Yeah, which is like, you know, hooray, the West is getting way drier. I mean, I'm not saying that, but it's like, for me personally, this is really, really fascinating. And of course, I have kids. I have a vested interest in the outcome.
I mean, there's also, I mean, so much of your work is about how Native people who, you know, again, our white European conception is, oh, lived in partnership with the land and, you know, didn't touch anything, that these folks were causing wide scale changes to the environment in their own way, in the same, not to a smaller degree than we are, and certainly a difference of kind and of degree, but that this is something humans do, that humans change the environment that we live in. Is that a comforting thought or is that a depressing thought to you?
Oh, I guess it's a comforting thought, in the sense that people make stuff and people change stuff. And that's what we do. And we've always done it. And maybe there was some perfect Edenic world, but it's been gone for 10,000 years, you know? And one of the things that strikes me, you know, you always are reading about this and you're thinking like, what was in their minds? Or at least I am trying to think about it. And it seemed to me that, I mean, this is a gross generalization because we're dealing with hundreds of different cultures, you know, and crazy different languages and belief systems and so forth. But over and over again, I think what these people were doing was making future environments. They were trying to build a world that they wanted to live in. And, you know, and that's why there'd be these investments by the Hohokam for generations and these massive, schemes to channel water, and harvest water. And why there is these, you know, things where they're burning and maintaining the landscape and actually incorporating the burning into their, you know, religious symbols so that it became, you know, a sacred duty to create this, and maintain this landscape. And I think like, you know, that's not a bad way to think. What world do we want to, what should the environment we live in look like? Let's build it.
Yes. Yeah. That comes to my, something I think about a lot is that, and I've talked about on the show before, is that, you know, we do to some extent need to embrace the fact that we fundamentally change the world that we live in. And that's something that humans do because only by embracing that can we accept that we have a choice in the future world that we're creating, and that we can create one that preserves as many of the things as we want to preserve as we can. Maybe not every single one, but, you know, as many species as we're able to, while also results in, you know, less death and more healthy, happy, flourishing lives for people. Hopefully.
And you also, thinking of that way, sometimes I think that you can solve multiple problems at once. There's a thing in architecture called alignment, which is when, you know, you build something and it does two or three things for you.
Yeah.
And so, for example, here I'm speaking to you from New England, and our forests are having some problems. They're mostly logged, you know, in the 19th century, and they're planted with fence posts, basically, and trees, you know, very straight trees that are used for railroad rails. And those trees are short-lived and they're all dying. I mean, they don't live that long. And so we're going to have pretty soon a whole lot of dead trees in our landscape. And so we're going to start having the kind of fires you guys are having.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much fuel, there. And the problem is nobody has any money to invest in, you know, this. So how can we generate this? We also have another problem. The most common tree in the entire East Coast forest was the American chestnut, which was wiped out by chestnut blight in beginning of 1904. They have now developed chestnuts, you know, that could go back in. And the chestnuts are a fantastically productive tree. About, I don't know, something like 40% of our agriculture doesn't go, you know, by weight, doesn't go to feeding people. It's used for chemicals and dyes and, you know, cattle food. Chestnuts are just great for this. So you could actually bring in something that would replace the dead trees, create a beautiful landscape. Chestnuts are beautiful, and be a productive industry that could take some of the weight off of the industry that's, you know, from that's threatened by the randomness of climate change. So that kind of thing. And we could say we could build a landscape with lots of chestnuts in it. It used to be something like a quarter of the trees east of the Mississippi were chestnuts. You know, you could build put a lot of chestnuts in and have a big impact in a beautiful environment and solve a bunch of environmental problems at the same time. At least, you know, again, now talking as the guy sitting next to you in the coffee shop that you can't escape from.
Well, OK, last question for you. As that guy, what animates you in the research projects that you pursue? I mean, as you said, you're a freelance writer. You can work on anything that you want. You've sold enough books that I think you can probably choose your topics. Is there something in the work that draws you to certain topics or themes or pursuits? Are you looking for something when you're?
Yeah, I can tell. It's like a feeling. You know, Nabokov called it that shiver up the nape of your spine, you know, or something like that. Mm. And for me, it's I grew up with my dad. You know, I he's a wonderful guy. Passed away a while ago, and he would come home from work. He ran a small business, and he's a smart guy. And he would have a pile of newspapers and books and magazines, and he would go through them, right? And if he felt like he was being talked down to or pedantic or there, you know, or whatever, didn't have a sense of humor, he had this basket in the corner of the room. He'd throw the stuff in the basket, you know, no. But his highest praise was my mother would be, you know, cooking and so forth. Is he would go, huh? And he'd run over and he'd say, Nina, I didn't know that. And he would tell her what he had just read. And this is like a tremendous pleasure for him. And I always think like, you know, am I, you know, when I'm writing, I'm looking for subject that it would make my dad go, I didn't know that. And when I'm writing, I'm also trying to think, am I in that basket? I don't want to go in the basket.
I love that so much. You're not in my basket. And your book made me exclaim in that way many times, or your books have.
Yeah.
I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. It's been such a pleasure and an honor to have you, Charles.
No, it's my pleasure, and I look forward to listening to you in the future, even when I'm not on.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Well, thank you once again to Charles Seaman for coming on the show. If you want to pick up his books, you can check them out at factuallypod.com/books. That's factuallypod.com/books. And if you purchase the book there, you'll be supporting not just this show, but your local bookstore as well. I want to thank our producers, Chelsea Jacobson and Sam Roudman, our engineer, Andrew Carson, Andrew WK, for our theme song, the fine folks at Falcon Northwest for building me the incredible custom gaming PC that I record this very episode on. You can find me online at adamconover.net or at adamconover wherever you get your social media. And until next time, thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate you here on the show for taking a listen, and we'll see you next week on Factually.
That was a HeadGum Podcast. Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.